previously on the Devil's Teeth podcast.
There was like a cross over her head, and then there was some stones around the top of her head, like a semicircle. And somebody come up with the idea that it might have been witchcraft, and that took off rumors in the town.
I can tell you that the Westfield Police Department had talked about finding books on that subject in the library of the List House.
Yeah, well, they tried to pass it off in the very beginning, Westfield did, as a satanic ritual.
Yeah, I definitely heard about the sacrifice rumors. That was in the paper. I mean, there was like little a stone in the shape of a coffin around her.
But there were like branches around the body, like a coffin.
The talk was that she was found on some kind of an altar with little wooden crosses surrounding her body.
Oh, he says, I'll never say another thing, but these meetings after what they did to me with the DePalma case.
There was a lot of talk before this happened that there was witches' covens or satanic rituals in the Watchung Reservation.
My brother, you know, used to go camping up there, so many times they'd come home in the middle of the night. You know, they would find unusual objects, sort of ritualistic type stuff.
What is the cause of death? If we don't have a cause of death, the only way we're going to be able to say that it's a homicide is someone comes forth and says, I killed her.
In the last episode, we discussed one of the major hindrances to the investigation into Jeanette DePalma's death, the lack of a cause. Dr. Bernard Ehrenberg, the medical examiner who conducted Jeanette's autopsy, said he could not rule out strangulation, but nevertheless could not sign off on an official cause of death either. As time went on, with no further answers forthcoming, Springfield citizens began to wonder if Jeanette had even been murdered at all. Many began to postulate that the teenager had merely succumbed to a drug overdose while partying with friends in the quarry, and, for some strange reason, her panicked peers threw some sticks and stones around her so it would look like a satanic sacrifice. One of the biggest proponents of the drug overdose theory was Springfield police officer Ed Kish.
Now I can only tell you as a patrol officer, prior to being assigned to detective or anything else like that, Jeanette DePalma was a party girl. There were certain places that were known as Lover's Lanes. You could always find Jeanette in the back of a car. She liked to party. I will tell you that as a patrol officer, I could find her in the backseat of cars. That they had been partying. Who her friends were, I don't know. I couldn't even tell you if the Springfield Police Department at that time even knew if she had a boyfriend, which I know she did.
Which boyfriend are you talking about? Because we've heard several names as far as boyfriends go.
I don't even believe that the Springfield Police Department ever checked in the town or interviewed any boyfriend that she might have had.
That's kind of unusual, isn't it? Isn't that always the first suspect?
I can't answer that question for you, Mark.
Well, I'm just saying, in general, police work isn't always the person's significant other, the first person that gets questioned.
If they're married, then it doesn't always work if they have a lot of political connections.
Are you implying something about the person?
No, I'll leave that one lie. I was able to determine through my police career that if you're a criminal, you're going to take the case to court because you've got a 50% chance of getting off. They don't have to be truthful. You do. And it's not whether they're guilty or innocent, it's whether they can fabricate a story to beat your case.
Right.
I had two of those.
Was this one of them?
I wouldn't say that is one of them. It's just a strange thing.
This has to be based solely on conjecture. How do you think that body ended up dead there?
All indications are, if I were to look back from what I've learned through my career, there's two things that happened that, unbeknownst to anybody else, there were a group of kids that were partying up there. They could have done drugs, and she could have overdosed and died there. Or there was a dump job.
It would have been a very difficult dump job based on the location, though, admittedly, right?
Don't underestimate the powers of the people when they become scared and the things that they will do.
So I'm just saying, for a person,
I understand what you're
carry
saying.
That body up to that place.
Yes, it was difficult to climb the side of that hill that we went up, and the only way that you were going to get it from the other side was with a ladder. That doesn't mean that it couldn't have been done. And is it possible that more than one person put the body up there?
Due to a fair amount of gossip regarding the DePalma family already circling around town, it was certainly easy for some Springfield residents to believe Jeanette may have been a heavy drug user. When I spoke with Roy Simpson, he recalled some of the rumors he heard about the DePalma family as he was growing up in nearby Mountainside.
The DePalma family has always kind of looked at as a tough, hard-nosed
you know, black sheep of the neighborhood kind of family. This is innuendo from what the neighborhood talk was at the time. It was considered to be kind of a tough family. You know, the girls were always kind of considered a little bit more on the sleazy side, which is a terrible thing to say, but that's the mood in the area at the time. Promiscuous, that was the talk at the time. We didn't really hear too much about drugs. And again, I was only 11, and I'm probably not very exposed to like that. I didn't find out until much later, until after the incident, that Jeanette, I guess, had gotten religious towards the end. What we remember from the neighborhood was the wild side. I can tell you firsthand that we never saw the religious side of it or heard about anything during the time this was happening. None of us ever remember that part of it. And like I said, I didn't even hear about that until years and years afterwards. I actually read it somewhere. But it was not common knowledge, certainly, in the neighborhood. It was more the sister's promiscuity is what we would hear about.
Jeanette's alleged spiritual awakening is a matter of bitter contention. Amid all of the rumors surrounding a satanic sacrifice and witchcraft, Jeanette's family was quick to point out that she had been active in their church for some time and would not have associated with anyone linked to a coven or cult. In a series of interviews with several New Jersey and New York newspapers, Sal and Florence De Palma described Jeanette as, quote, someone who tried to lead others to Jesus, and claimed that she worked as a drug and alcohol counselor at their house of worship, the Evangel Assemblies of God Church in Elizabeth. Now, if you think the idea of a teenage drug and alcohol counselor is a tad bizarre, you're definitely not alone. When I spoke with Jeanette's best friend, Gail Donahue, she had this to say about the matter.
Oh, God, do you see what they did? Their sick minds, their sick religious minds, they glorified her. They made her into something she never was. What credentials could you have just short of 16 years old to be a drug and alcohol counselor?
So that must explain it, right? Jeanette's parents made up a few white lies to the newspapers in order to make the drug overdose rumors go away. Seems pretty cut and dry, right? Well, maybe not. While writing Death on the Devil's Teeth, I spoke with Curtis Dady, who was active in the Evangel Assemblies of God Church, specifically at their youth outreach center in downtown Elizabeth called His Place. When we spoke, Dady had this to say regarding the possibility of Jeanette being a, quote, drug and alcohol counselor.
We had a hotline, helpline, and things like that. The idea was, you know, to help kids that were street, you know, that we would call street kids today, or in those days, I don't know if we call them homeless or street kids, or I don't remember what, but they were, you know, kids were experimenting with drugs and whatnot, and having trouble in overdose, and having trouble with their families and whatnot. And so this idea of a helpline, hotline, it was called Contact. The young people would be trained answer the phone, but be available to listen, you know, to be a compassionate, empathetic listener. You know, there was no directed counseling or anything like that. They would take a class or a few classes, I don't remember what the curriculum was, but there was basically these weekly sessions on how to be an outreach to people in trouble. So basically it's just saying, you know, somebody calls up on the phone and they say, my parents just kicked me out and I'm out of money and I'm high on drugs and I'm thinking about committing suicide or whatever. And the kids on the phone would say, you know, we want you to know that God loves you, we love you, why don't you come down to the center, let's have a cup of coffee, you know, it's not worth taking your life at this point.
A slight exaggeration, but Jeanette most likely did work as some form of a counselor at His Place. Granted, she was not performing direct treatment to drug and alcohol abusers, but she was most likely providing a shoulder to cry on through her work operating the telephones at His Place. But, with all of that in mind, does that leave us any closer to figuring out what kind of person Jeanette really was? Was she the kind-hearted Christian working to help New Jersey's down-and-out teenage population? Or was she the drugged-out, promiscuous wild child that Ed Kish and people who gossiped to Roy Simpson talked about? Will the real Jeanette De Palma please stand up? Another person who can give some context to this issue is Jeanette's best friend, Gail Donahue. When I spoke with Gail in 2014, she told me a pretty interesting story that, in my mind at least, lays waste to the idea of Jeanette being a hardcore drug user.
My father, he became an executive, but he came from a very poor background, and he became a self-made man, and he became very appreciative of his compliments. You know, we always had fine china. He always had this, he was very proud of his liquor cabinet. He always had every cognac, everything that you want. And the one time, that's exactly what my mind went to, was Jeanette and I taking a sip stop, maybe a little whiskey, and then both of us jumping up and down, next thing you know, saying, are we drunk yet?
definitely doesn't sound like someone that would have a knowledge of hardcore drug use, right?
No, hell no.
So here we have a teenaged girl, only days past turning 16, who had recently asked her best friend, if we jump up and down after drinking this booze, will we get drunk quicker? And the cops are trying to imply to the public that, oh no, she just went off into the woods and overdosed, or, oh, she overdosed at a party and was probably dumped there. Sounds a little strange, doesn't it? Over the course of the 3 years that Mark and I spent researching and writing Death on the Devil's Teeth, we never encountered a single person who knew Jeanette De Palma in life and knew her to engage in any kind of drug use other than smoking the occasional joint with friends. Also, one must wonder what kind of drug that could kill a person with one dose could a 16-year-old girl growing up in suburban white bread America have gained access to? Jeanette De Palma wasn't exactly living in the inner city. This was suburban Union County in 1972. Most teenagers were smoking pot, boozing, or occasionally expanding their consciousness through LSD use. None of these things can kill a person in one sitting. So why were people so insistent on the public believing that this girl just overdosed in the woods? Could it be they were looking for the real problem to just go away? Did these people not want to believe that a murderer might be in their midst? Were the rumors of a cult or a witch coven finally starting to get to them? 44 years later, the jury is still out. But for now, it's pretty safe to assume that if you put Jeanette De Palma, the supposed party girl, on one side, and Jeanette De Palma, the pious devout Christian, on the other, it's pretty safe to assume that the true answer most likely lies somewhere in the middle. A mildly rebellious teen who eventually turned to Christ by joining her family at the Evangel Assemblies of God Church. While attending services at Evangel, the De Palma family did attract a certain amount of attention to itself due to their original religious background. When we spoke in 2014, Curtis Dady explained to me why.
You know, my recollection, the best thing for me is, and I mentioned the De Palma family, I had not heard that name or thought of that name for 3 years until you mentioned it just now. My recollection is that they were kind of like old pillars of the church, their family. And in my mind, it's kind of they were an old Italian Catholic family that converted, and but they were real, a lot of influence.
One has to bear in mind that back in 1972, a suburban Roman Catholic family suddenly converting to born-again Christianity was pretty out there. This was the beginning of the whole born-again Jesus freak movement, so the De Palmas were definitely on the forefront. So, how well were the De Palmas received in their new church? Well, back in 2012, I spoke with a very controversial figure in this case, the leader of their church, Pastor James Tate. When I asked Pastor Tate what he remembered of the girl on the mountain, this is what he had to say.
Her family was attending our church, and she had also attended the church. Although she did not really become a part of the church, she was reading a book on Satanism, and I think was involved with a group of people that were meeting up in the mountain there.
Is that the group that were the newspapers were calling the witches?
Probably, yes.
They're the ones that were suspected of meeting in a Watchung Reservation, right?
Exactly.
And how did you come to meet Jeanette and her family? Was it through her sister, Gwen?
Gwen, I think, was the first one who came to our church. And then the family started coming. And it was during the season that we would call, in spiritual circles, the Jesus Movement, when there were so many young people turning to the Lord. And our church was inundated with young people during that time, just coming from everywhere. So Jeanette came, but I don't think I could say that her interests were really in Jesus as much as they were her involvement in the occult. She was definitely involved with some occult things. You know how they found her, right? You know, it seemed like that her body, the way it was found, appeared to have been an offering because they put that wooden frame around it.
The top of the cliff that she was at was actually very high up. She would have had to have been brought there of her own accord. I heard that it took the fire department's ladder trucks in order to safely get her down from there.
I do believe that that was part of the story.
If she had gone there, it would have been someone that she had known. You would.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Someone or someones. It probably was more than one.
You do think it was more than one attacker?
Well, if it was an offering, it wouldn't have been called an attack. It would have been their worship.
And do you think that Jeanette would have willingly have taken place in that, or she could have been maybe drugged or knocked out?
That, you know, it seems almost impossible to think that someone was willing to do that. Our Lord did for us, but, you know, it's because she was involved in something that was so marginal. You know, the whole witchcraft, Satanist thing, the occult was, and still is, so marginal. It's not, it's just so strange that she wanted to be involved with that, especially when her family was getting so involved with the Lord.
Do you think that may have been her own personal way of maybe rebellion towards her parents?
I was just going to say, knowing her, it probably was an act of rebellion. She was a very rebellious girl.
Do you have any theories on why? I mean, it's not just the police that are very quiet and guarded. Even people that just lived in Springfield around the time don't want to talk about it. Do you think that there's any specific reason for how quiet everything is, the rumors of a cover-up and everything?
Yeah, I wouldn't understand what that motivation would be, really. We live in a culture right now that so many people just don't want to get involved with anything. They just don't want involvement because they're so afraid of what it might lead to as far as legally.
You know, no one seems to want to help anymore. They seem to be afraid of something.
Isn't that strange?
It's very strange. It was 40 years ago this year. It's you often wonder if the person that was involved in this with Jeanette actually was maybe the son or daughter of an active police member.
Wonder if they're still living, too.
Yeah. The general consensus is the people that were involved are still alive. Weird New Jersey magazine, they get constant letters giving tips and recollections, and the one thing that the editors of the magazine have said is they are anonymous on blank envelopes.
No. My goodness, I can't imagine.
And
I can't imagine why. It all sounds familiar, doesn't it? It seems like something is being hidden, doesn't it?
It definitely does. It just makes you wonder by who.
Yeah, right.
To be honest, I was very surprised to hear that Jeanette had an interest in the occult, because all of these newspaper articles paint her as a very pious and devout parishioner.
Her mother would have been the one who told me that she found those books on the occult in Jeanette's room, but she would never tell that because she wanted the picture of Jeanette that was in the public eye to be good. Those things never would come out. Her mom was trying to paint a beautiful picture. I guess that's understandable, but certainly doesn't help to keep the facts straight.
Talk about a revelation. It would certainly be one thing if Pastor Tate was merely joining the ranks of those who maintain Jeanette was a wild child party girl. But this is different. If we are to believe what he says, Jeanette was actually an aspiring occultist herself, reading books on the subject and meeting with a supposed coven of witches inside the Watchung Reservation. This revelation is made all the more shocking by the simple fact that Pastor Tate had championed Jeanette as a little Christian warrior when speaking with several major newspapers in 1972. For further context, I spoke with another friend of Jeanette's who also attended the Evangel Assemblies of God Church. He asked me not to use his name, so we'll call him Joseph. When I asked Joseph if he recalled Jeanette being wild or a practitioner of occult rituals, he had this to say.
I did know Jeanette. And I knew her two sisters and her mom and dad, too, actually. I mean, I had dinner over the house a couple times. I had anything to do with occult and all that stuff. I didn't know anything about that. I'd never heard about that. If she was wild, I knew nothing about that. Jeanette was definitely not quite like that at all. I would have to say that she was pretty sweet the way I remember.
During my initial interview with Pastor Tate, he did volunteer to me that his son Wayne had at one point been romantically involved with Jeanette. He gave me Wayne's email address and told me to reach out. When I later spoke with Wayne, he told me with zero hesitation that he had never known Jeanette to have any interest in the occult whatsoever. I can only speculate that this kind of bizarre behavior from the Tate family contributed to Joseph's eventual break from the Evangel Church.
Like, you know, man, you guys want to do some good. Don't stand there like, you know, donate money when the pastor needs a new van, you know, and they're all standing up their business, who can donate more money, you know, I don't come from this, I don't come from a rich family or anything like that. I grew up in North, you know what I mean? I grew up in a shithole. From hanging around with people with a lot of money who were trying to outbid each other to look like who's got more money, and then I heard afterwards that there was a big drug thing going on that I guess the church split too because the pastor was on some kind of, you know, prescription drugs and he was losing it and all kinds of weird shit. I don't know if that's true. They were what they were, man. It's a, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just it's a whole load of crap and it's a whole load of, you know, they just don't believe in any of that shit. They believe in getting people's money and that they're hoping to show. Or at least that was. I mean, that's the way I walked away from it. I was like, you know what? I want to see a show. I'm going to go pay $10 and see Led Zeppelin instead of seeing Pastor Pete get up there and get all excited about some bullshit that, you know, at this point I can't even believe in.
So here we are again, back at the world's greatest game of he said, she said. We may never know what type of person Jeanette really was. At the end of the day, does it really matter? Does Jeanette De Palma being a wild child party girl or pious devout parishioner of the Evangelical Church really change what happened that day on the Devil's Teeth? In the next episode, we're going to go back to that day, August 7th, 1972, the day Jeanette De Palma went missing. Special thanks to Mark Moran, Mark Skirman, Don Schwert, Rusty and Christina from Antiquity Echoes, Ed Kish, Curtis Dady, Roy Simpson, Joseph from Newark, Pastor James Tate, and Weird New Jersey's Cult of the Letter Senders.